Hey there. Welcome to one of our first stories of the podcast. I'm David All, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. In season three, we shouldered up with you and made it clear that this podcast is not for sale. No advertising or outside influence, a sacred and safe space. Starting with season three, we dedicate a poem to one of our listeners that is standing with us as an enabler of our mission. They're doing so by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. To be true to our word, we're going back through some of our earlier content in seasons one and two and removing the segments that we feel may not be congruent with this idea. So enjoy. This story, like every other story on our podcast, is now 100% advertising free. A safe space where you can let your guard down, listen, and notice if something comes up in your soul. If you would like to be an enabler, and we certainly could use your help, visit bellystory.com and chip in $5 today. Now, here's that extraordinary life story.
Looking in the mirror at myself, I didn't see somebody I knew. I saw somebody who looked scared and defeated, definitely. And more than anything, I think I saw someone who just wanted to press the reset button on my life. And yet I had been trying to.
This podcast is about the time we all get knocked down in life and climb up a new person. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts. Let me introduce you to Chip Conley. In business, the term disruptor is reserved for those individuals that completely change the rules in an industry so that every other person in that industry has to follow suit. Chip has done that twice. The first was at Joie de Vivre Hospitality, which he grew to become the second largest independent boutique hospitality group in the country, and then at Airbnb as the chief hospitality officer, where he helped guide the rocket ship and provide all of the expertise around hospitality so that the company could become what it is today. Chip is a New York Times best-selling author. His five books have made him a leading authority at the intersection of psychology and business. Conley picked up a nickname at Airbnb as their modern elder, and it stuck. In fact, he's running the Modern Elder Academy in Baja, Mexico, where folks ages 35 to 70 are finding out that being an elder is just as much about being curious as it is about being wise. Chip Conley, welcome to Belly of the Beast Life Stories.
I'm nervous. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Chip, I'd love it if you could take us to the moment of hearing Aretha Franklin singing Amazing Grace in your car.
Yeah. So I was, I'll give you the brief version and then we'll give backstory to it. I was at a stage in my life where it felt like everything was conspiring against me, and I had the keys to the car and I was ready to go drive to the Golden Gate Bridge. I was a hotelier in San Francisco, the largest operator of hotels in San Francisco, boutique hotels, and a relationship going bad, going into the Great Recession, my foster son on his way to San Quentin wrongfully. One of my best friends, who has the same name as me, Chip, had committed suicide. And I was really in a state of almost disbelief at how many things were going wrong at the same time. And I tried calling my friend Vanda and couldn't get a hold of her at first. And so I was there in the car with my keys, ready to go drive. And then, you know, Amazing Grace comes on. And I just immediately had the full tearful reaction to the idea that I could have another choice. I didn't have to imagine committing suicide as a way of pressing the reset button on my life. And in the prior few months, I had told friends of mine that I'd been having dreams or nightmares of cancer and car crashes. And so I guess there was a point at which I just said, listen, I rather than just try to end it all, and I know how that will end. I know how the end of that story is. Instead, let me stick around and see how this movie plays out. And it actually got more interesting, which I will talk about.
So I want to go back to your several friends that committed suicide within a 2-year period. And the book that you gave me about this period of your life between the ages of 45 and 50, you talk about the fact that you like respected suicide as a means of quieting the chaos of horror they felt inside. Can you just talk us through that?
Yeah, I think what I've come to realize is that in many ways, there were five guys, all between age 42 and 52, and they were, on average, amongst the five of them, they were seeing their sense of self-esteem and self-worth as being a function of how their career, or in three of the cases as entrepreneurs, how their business was going. So there was that. I think beyond that, there was also a sense that their whole sense of identity was wrapped up in success and in looking good. And, you know, what we know about people today in their 40s is this is it's probably the hardest decade of adulthood. The U-curve of happiness, which has been studied by social scientists, shows that people between about age 45 and 50 hit the bottom of their happiness or satisfaction level in life, and things start to get better from that point forward. But it's a long 20-year decline from mid-20s. So what I can say now, with a little bit of objectivity, is that this is a very rough period of time. It was a time where the Great Recession was in full swoon. And in many cases, there were external factors, especially around people's careers, that were conspiring to make people feel like they didn't have another option. And what I was feeling, I just didn't want to wake up each morning. I didn't want to wake up to more bad news. You know, ultimately, on a personal level, I ended up having a flatline experience. And I had an experience where I had a broken ankle and a bacterial infection in my leg. And I was on a strong antibiotic, and I was giving a speech in St. Louis. And after the speech, signing books, I was luckily sitting down, and I went unconscious. And when the paramedics showed up, I actually went flatline. And I see the book here on the desk here. I went flatline 9 times over the course of 90 minutes on the way to the hospital and in the emergency room. And each time I'd go to the flatline, I'd come back to life and talk to the nurse who's holding my hand and tell her what I'd seen. It was the same thing over and over again. Maybe we'll come back to that. But what I can say is that that evening after emergency room, ICU, and now in my own little hospital room, I had this book, Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, in my backpack. Partly because I was trying to make sense of Chip's suicide. And now here I am. I didn't commit suicide, but I actually died. And what came out of that almost all-night reading of the book was this equation, which was despair equals suffering minus meaning. And what I take from that equation, that's not in his book, but it's the way I distilled down almost a mantra from that famous book, Man's Search for Meaning by Frankl. And the whole premise is that, you know, suffering sort of exists out there. If you're a Buddhist, you know it's the first noble truth of Buddhism. It's sort of just ever present. And meaning and despair are inversely proportional to each other. So actually, if you're feeling a lot of despair, the thing to figure out is how do you find some meaning in your life? So that was my solution from that day forward, is on a daily basis, I asked myself, what did I learn today? How do I have a sense of meaning, or a sense of having created some wisdom in my life? And that's part of how I started to emotionally and maybe psychologically recover.
What was going on inside you? If you can talk about like depression, because you pointed out a lot of maybe external factors, yeah, things that were happening in your life, but what was going on inside of you?
You're tough, aren't you? So what was happening inside of me, I felt just this heavy blanket on top of me. I felt very dark inside. I felt I think the word I felt more than anything was cursed. I felt cursed. And to feel cursed is an awful feeling. And you know, some of it was feeling like externally cursed, and some of it was feeling internally cursed. Like, okay, this is the suffering is part of my life. This is what I'm supposed to experience. But what I felt really awkward about was like, I felt really ill-equipped to deal with everything externally happening. So let's also give backstory. I was running the second largest boutique hotel company in the US called Joie de Vivre. And I wasn't feeling much Joie de Vivre, which means joy of life in French. And I was really in a state of disbelief that I was supposed to somehow, in a time where I felt completely ill-equipped to even show up at work, to somehow be figuring out how to save a company of 3,500 employees, while I was just like, you know, frankly, on an internal basis, just trying to figure out how to save myself. So there was a deep sense of responsibility, which was weighing heavily on me. And yeah, I felt, I didn't feel any sexual or romantic attraction. I had a relationship that was in the later stages of just about to end. I was...
And on that point,
yeah,
you wrote that you felt alone in a 7-year relationship.
Yeah. And it was 7 years, and it was a year later that we actually broke up. It was an 8-year relationship ultimately. Yeah. I mean, one of the worst feelings, many of us have had this experience when to be single and to be alone in that way is one thing. To be in a relationship and to feel alone actually feels worse, in my opinion. And it feels worse partly because there's also the element of trying to make it look good or feel good, look good to the outside world, feel good to us. And it wasn't working. So, and in this case, it was even worse. It was worse because I sort of wanted it to work. He was my life preserver. His name is Donald. Donald was my life preserver. He's a doctor. And I sort of felt like both mental health wise as a doctor and as my partner, I was looking for someone to help me during what was a difficult time. And, you know, he's a great guy, so I don't want to beat him up here. But what I will say is that he had moved on, and is you know, in all kinds of ways. And so, yeah, I felt, I also felt, you know, of course, rejected. Even before we broke up, I felt, this is because what we're talking about right now is the summer before, a year later, we broke up. But all of this was happening. And yet, who was I talking to? Yeah, I was talking to friends about it. Yeah, let's just recognize one other thing. So 5 men committed suicide, friends of mine, between 42 and 52. Men are much more likely to successfully, I hate to use that word, commit suicide than women. Women actually try it, not as much as men, I think about half as much as men, but are less likely to have it work, partly because men use guns more and women tend to use pills more. And a gun's more lethal in a lot of cases. So I guess for me, at the end of the day, what I think was happening inside was the start of a rehabilitation. The start of me starting to see inside and realize that I'd been living my life way too externally for too long. And I felt this enormous gap between what I felt and what I was trying to show to the world. And if it had been just purely my own life, that'd be one thing, but that trying to save this company and, you know, not have all my employees get fired because the company would go bankrupt was another element that was hard. But I ultimately sold the company 2 years later at the bottom of the market. It was like, from a financial perspective, and the, you know, my financial friends were like, what are you doing? You're an idiot. It's the terrible time to sell the company. It's like, well, you know what? It's either that or the Golden Gate Bridge. So it turned out to be an enormous relief because I actually, you know, the interesting thing about Man's Search for Meaning is it's the story of being in a concentration camp. And I felt like I was in prison. And so the process of starting to strip away the things that made me feel like I was in prison helped me to free myself to a place where I had more spaciousness to go inside. And frankly, at the end of the day, the way I recovered from this was going inside.
So you're staring in the mirror, right before you went out to the garage to get into the car. And you said that you looked in the mirror for 10 minutes and you saw a man defeated.
Mm. Yeah.
And you grabbed some pills.
Yeah.
You grabbed something to write with.
Mm-hmm.
And your car keys.
Yeah. I figured I'd actually take the pills. I mean, I was like, take the pills like early enough so that when I actually jump, it won't be as painful when I hit. So I didn't know if I was going to overdose. I really hadn't thought it through, but I figured, okay, I'll take enough pills. So by the time I sort of get up and over the railing on the Golden Gate Bridge, that I'll be pretty numb. Yeah. So looking in the mirror at myself, I didn't see somebody I knew. I saw somebody who looked scared and defeated, definitely. And more than anything, I think I saw someone who just wanted to press the reset button on my life. And yet I had been trying to. And yet I was being haunted at night by these cancer and car crash nightmares. So it was almost, I was almost willfully bringing it on. And so that was not easy.
Chip just told us the story of a difficult few years of his life where everything was going wrong and he felt quote unquote cursed. And where we are in this story is that he's in the garage in his car considering driving to the Golden Gate Bridge to jump. And a song, Amazing Grace, comes on.
Yeah. And then I called my friend Vanda and I told her where it was, and I didn't even have a garage, so it was on the street. I was like, yeah, I hadn't driven anywhere yet. I was right in front of my home, and I just told her, like, the Amazing Grace just come on, and I was like, okay, so here's what's going on. And we talked, and she sort of talked me off the bridge, so to speak, in the sense that she helped me to see that. And while she was, while we were having this conversation, I was digging the car keys into my palm of my hand, so much so that the next morning I looked at it and I had actually created a scab. So obviously there had been blood. I didn't feel it at the time. I hadn't taken any of the pills yet, but I was just like, I was so numb that I didn't even realize that I was digging these keys into my palm of the hand. So she helped me to say, go inside, pulls away, take a couple of sleeping pills because, you need something to just knock you out right now. And then we're going for a walk in the morning. And she said, I'll come over right now if you want me to. She lives in Marin. I live in San Francisco, so it was not going to be easy for her to get there. She's probably 35, 40 minutes away. Because I'm sort of southern part of the city. And so I went inside, and then we went for a walk in Marin the next day. And it was just a really interesting thing, you know, when you can get out of your own way and the sort of the room that's closing in on you. Nature can be such a healing cathedral. And we were walking through on a sunny day, beautiful air quality. And I was just smelling the trees. And I think there was an element for me that I realized how small of a life I'd created for myself, because it was completely possessed my self-absorption of how do I get out of all this crap happening to me. And so, I was not smelling roses. I wasn't smelling trees. I wasn't even realizing that there's a lot of beauty in the world. And so in some ways, what I started to do is a combination from that point forward, developed a weekly inventory of my meaning inventory, my wisdom inventory. What did I learn this week? What did I get through? How is this experience making me a better person? And where did I see beauty? So it was the combination of the internal resources feeling like they're starting to fuel me into being a better person, and then me getting out of the internal space to see external beauty. And so a lot of time in nature. And Vanda helped me with that.
One of the things that you wrote about during this phase was that the mask that had been suffocating you was starting to loosen its
grip. So, I often talk about mask and masculinity. Some of it was a masculinity mask. Some of it was just my mask of the identity I'd been portraying to the world. And so what was that? Well, you know, I was a kid who grew up I was the only son, and Stephen Connelly, Townsend Connelly Jr., the chip off the old block. My dad was a Marine captain, and I was a great athlete. I was an achiever because to achieve meant I got love. And so I was sort of an achievement addict and an admiration addict. And so that's how I built a self-esteem, and I built quite, you know, a path of success. And I, you know, I went through my internal world. So that was the good news. Again, coming out as a gay man at age 22, it was really hard on my dad and both my parents. And it was hard for my world around me because they weren't expecting it. But at the same time, there was an element for me is like it relieved me a little of having to try to live someone else's life. But as much as I thought I was just living my own life, in many ways, I was still on the treadmill of the admiration addict. And so I think the mask that I was wearing was the mask of the achiever, the mask of somebody who knew it all, not from a place of arrogance, but a place from having metabolized a lot. And then there was the masculinity piece of you know, being the CEO of a company and being somebody who's out there, you know, advocating as a business leader for alternative ways to operate as a business. And so in many ways, I think there was a sense that I needed to put down the mask and instead of trying to portray success, what I wanted to portray was authenticity. And that's really been, I think, my way of being since then, since 2008, so 11 years now. And nobody would say pre that time that I wasn't authentic. But I was authentic, I was portraying authenticity as opposed to being authenticity. And there's a difference. And the difference is there's not a filter. So just like right now, being authentic means you're just really not actually scheming and packaging. And you know, how do you know you're not? You know, still, you still might think you're not when you really are. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of caution I have to have on that. But I think more than anything, the idea of loosening the mask and just sort of being myself a little bit more, and then, yeah, frankly, selling my company having never thought I was going to, selling it. It was not a failure. So I didn't, like, the good news is I didn't have to go bankrupt and have a very public failure. And it was a private sale. And so, but I know on a personal level, it did feel like a failure. I expected to run that company until I was 75 or 80, and I was selling at the bottom of the recession. But more than anything, the sense of freedom. The freedom from the mask, the freedom from the responsibilities. I started the company for creativity and freedom. And 22, 24 years into it, I didn't feel a lot of creativity or freedom.
Your first hotel in San Francisco was called The Phoenix.
Yes.
And The Phoenix is an important animal to you.
Yeah, you know, the phoenix means it's the mythological bird that rises from its own ashes. I'm a Scorpio in terms of my sun sign, which is also a phoenix has an element to that because the Scorpio is well known for regenerating itself and being able to sting, but then there's a regeneration. So there's an element for me that, you know, the comeback kid, I guess, of how do I find myself in peril, get through it, and then actually become stronger as a result of it. There's no doubt that this experience, which was really my worst experience of my life, helped me get to the other side.
And I think that your story is so beautiful because it's, you know, you can see like all of these different things contributing to this one moment where you're in the car. And then right after that, you know, you talk about feeling a shift inside of you on New Year's. Your company gets acquired. You do a TED Talk.
Wow. Yeah, that was big. But yes, you know, there was a directional change. There's a trajectory in life. And sometimes the trajectory feels like it's just unrelentingly down. At some point, it started to feel like it was coming back. And I think more than anything, what I felt along that way is as I reached out to a collection of family and friends beyond Vanda, I just felt this deep sense of love and support. And absolutely that, okay, it's only in my head that if I don't accomplish, you won't love me. That's what I grew up with. But that's not what my sphere of people who love me think of me. In fact, they love me more for being less of an achiever, because when Chip's in his achievement mode, he's not even that available because he's so busy.
Suicide rates continue to skyrocket, especially for young people. What advice do you have for families or for anyone that knows friends that are talking about it?
So I think, you know, I know for young people for sure. I also know the suicide rate for women 45 to 64 has gone up 60% since the year 2000, 37% for men. The only reason the percentage is higher for women is starting from a lower base. So what would I suggest? First of all, look for the signs. Look for someone who's withdrawing more, who feels like they have lost an appetite for life. Look for someone who talks in sometimes quite tragic terms about their life, and help them to know that you love them no matter what. I think that's the key. I think conditional versus unconditional love is a big piece of this. Also helping them to see that there are more options available to them. I think that's the biggest one, is that I felt like I only had one option. It was either cancer, a car crash, or jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And those are not very good options. I had a lot more options. Yes, I could sell my company. I didn't think I could. I was like, okay, yeah, we'll figure that out. So I think, you know, helping people to see options, because when you're no matter what, if you're in an argument with your spouse and it's terrible and you talk about it with a good friend, your good friend's going to be able to give some objectivity to help you to see that there are alternative ways for you to actually take your steps moving forward. And certainly when someone's actually thinking about taking their life, it's good for them to understand there are other options.
So you wrote a book during this phase as well?
I sold the company, and then I said, I'm going to write this book called Emotional Equations, because that equation, despair equals suffering minus meaning, was a lifeline for me on a bad day. I would say that equation 30 or 40 times as just a reminder. And that's why at the end of the week, putting my list together of what's meaning, you know, what creates meaning, what, you know, is creating a sense of wisdom in my life was important to me. And I started looking at other equations, an equation for happiness, an equation for disappointment, and an equation for, you know, faith and wisdom. And what that led me to is thinking, like, you know, I'm a man, and men are logical about their emotions. And it made me realize how many people out there are never took an emotions 101 class. You know, you learn it from your parents, which is not exactly the best teacher. They're not the best teachers. And so I realized that I wanted to offer sort of a logical means of being more fluent about our emotions.
And so one of those was, and you brought it up earlier, despair equals suffering minus meaning.
Yeah.
And you included that in the book.
Yeah.
And that was right why you wrote the book, pretty much.
Yeah, that one. And there's another one called anxiety equals uncertainty times powerlessness. And so the key to that one, if you want to actually reduce your anxiety, is how do you create a little bit more certainty or a little bit more sense of influence to having some power? So
what's the equation to end loneliness?
Love squared. You know, and love can, you could say love's the equation for everything, but I think when it comes to loneliness, it's probably, you know, interestingly enough, both words start with the letters L-O. And so I think loneliness in many cases has a lot to do with feeling not just the sense of isolation, but sometimes the sense of unworthiness. And so I think, you know, when love can help a person feel worthy. Loneliness is a very interesting subject, because I'm spending more and more of my life right now focusing on people who are older. And it's interesting how people have sort of two trajectories as they get older. Either they tend to get a little bit more social and emotional, and they create space in their life to have connections, or they do the opposite. And when they do the opposite, the health consequences are so obvious. I mean, it's when someone gets lonelier, they feel more of a sense of despair. They feel less reason to stay on the planet, etc. And, you know, now in the UK, they even have like a minister of loneliness whose job it is to actually look at how to reduce the sense of especially urban loneliness.
Did you ever specifically state that you're choosing life?
Because
you were almost killed physically.
Yeah. I don't recall ever sort of saying to myself, I am choosing life. And I did start, I kept doing a series of three prayers and four mantras. The prayers I would say once each, and the mantras I'd say three times each, four of them. Some of those actually helped me. And some of them relate a little bit to feeling a sense of worthiness to be on the planet. But no, I didn't ever say anything specific to that.
All right. Chip, you wrote this quote, and I'd love for you to talk about it in the context of this story. You said, the most important challenge in one's life might be showing the willingness to give up who you are in order to find out who you might become.
Yeah, that really is what I did here. And what's funny, what's beautiful, if I can be helpful to someone out there who's listening right now who doesn't know if they can do that, let go, they can't let go of who they are in order to become who they need to become. Just recognize that the journey from the caterpillar to butterfly has a cocoon, a very dark cocoon, a gooey cocoon in the middle. And for me, this gooey cocoon was from age 45 to 49. And then on the other side of that, my 50s, I'm turning 59 later this month, and my 50s have absolutely been a period of butterfly. Not all perfect. Yes, lots of problems. Damien's sons became almost like my sons. One of them ended up committing suicide. There's some awful things that have happened in my 50s. But I think what has been fascinating is the identity that was like a straitjacket for me of being the founder and CEO of Joie de Vivre. That's what I was going to be forever. And that's where my sense of self-worth came from. When I let go of that and put that straitjacket away, I was able to get to a place of seeing what I had to offer the world in all kinds of new ways, philanthropically, just my heart, building even deeper relationships with family and friends. And ultimately, I got tapped on the shoulder by the three founders of Airbnb to help them basically steer their rocket ship for the last 7 years when it was a small tech company. And so that would never have happened. If I had still been, you know, struggling running my company, they would never have come looking for me. Interestingly enough, they had read my book, Peak, the Maslow book, and they said, we want this to be our company. And, you know, we've seen what you've done and will you come help us? And so sometimes you have to actually open up space in your life to see what's going to emerge.
Hmm. So what are you doing now? I mean, what is this Modern Elder Academy?
I'm hanging out with you. So, well, my experience at Airbnb was fascinating. I thought I was the mentor to Brian, the CEO, but I quickly realized I was as much an intern as I was a mentor because I'd never worked in a tech company before. I'm 52 years old at the time, and I was lost. And what I really learned quickly is the best elders, an elder is somebody, in, relatively speaking, older than the people around them, who actually are as curious as they are wise. And so the elder of the past was regarded with reverence, but the elder of the modern day is appreciated for their relevance. It's not about reverence, but relevance. And relevance requires that you are curious because you need to have some context in terms of how you deliver your wisdom. And so curiosity opens up possibility. And wisdom distills down what's important. And that combination in one person, I guess me, as the modern elder at Airbnb, allowed me to be full of inquisitiveness and at times be like the intern with lots of questions that were catalytic. And then other times when I was like, oh, I am, you know, the person who's sort of trying to make sense of all the mess we have here and the confusion. And distill it down to what's essential and prioritize. And so I ultimately wrote this book called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder as a result of that. But while I was writing the book, I came to the conclusion that I have had a bunch of friends who committed suicide in midlife because they couldn't make sense of midlife, especially couldn't make sense of how to repurpose themselves, how to press the reset button. And so I decided to create the world's first midlife wisdom school called the Modern Elder Academy on a 4-acre campus an hour north of Cabo San Lucas in Mexico.
What ages are you talking about here?
It's interesting. So we thought it'd be mostly people 45 to 65, average age 52. It has been average age 52. But it's been from age 30 to 78. I did not expect people in their 30s to be coming to a place called the Modern Elder Academy. But there's a lot of people who are in transition and trying to navigate through midlife transitions. And so I think midlife is now really 35 to 75 because there are people, especially in certain industries, who are feeling irrelevant earlier because of the digital age. And then there's people who are going to be in the workplace by choice or necessity longer because they're going to live longer. So 35 to 75 is the bulk of the people coming. And it's been phenomenal. 500 alums, 17 countries. And what it's really helped me to see is that we have an enormous gulf between the societal narrative on aging and the personal one. The societal one basically says you stumble into midlife, you have a crisis. And on the other side of that, if you can get through it, is decrepitude and death. Whereas the personal narrative, by as defined by the U-curve of happiness, which is hugely prevalent all around the world and been studied, shows that people actually do get happier in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, partly because they do the great midlife edit. And that's what we help people with down at the Modern Elder Academy. We help them to see what it's time to shed, whether it's a mindset, an identity, responsibilities, certain kinds of friends or family. What is it that you're ready to let go of and evolve out of? And then what can come into your life that's fresh and new? For me, it's learning how to surf. It's learning Spanish. It's a few other things. And these are things you don't usually think about doing in the, you know, in your late 50s.
You know, about this period of time between 45 and 49, you said, you know, this book you wrote is an attempt to find some harmonic good amidst the rubble. And I wonder, what is the good that came out of this situation in your life, this time period in your life?
I mean, I think the, you know, I've spent my life being a for-profit entrepreneur and now I'm a social entrepreneur. My history was finding a consumer need, especially in the hospitality business, and filling it, whether it was with boutique hotels or home sharing. Now I am trying to fill not a consumer need, but a society need, which is helping people to feel relevant and enthusiastic and engaged by life in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And so if there's something that's positive that's come out of this, it's the fact that I am, you know, as an ode to my friend Chip, who committed suicide, and four others, the fact that I almost did myself, and the fact that this is a rampant epidemic in the U.S. today, I'm really trying to help people to see that they have more options. And to see that, frankly, aging can be aspirational, which is sort of a funky thing to say in a world where, you know, we sort of imagine people getting older and it just sort of gets worse. But in fact, it can get better. And yes, our body does start to deteriorate it. And just as you get comfortable in your own skin, it starts to sag. That is true. But your heart, your soul, and some of the qualities of your life, and especially your sense of how you take care of yourself and how you're maybe more charitable to yourself. These are things that on average get better as we age.
I mean, you're an expert in emotional intelligence. So could you sort of rate yourself before this time period in your life and then after?
Well, I would say, definitely better. I don't even know. I don't want to rate because, you know, rating is how I used to do things. So I'm going to push back on you and say, I've spent my life, you know, looking for the Olympic judges to put up the 10 sign. You know, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not going to do it to myself. What I can say is my definition of success is not some internal or external judge with a rating card. It's how do I cultivate joie de vivre in my life. So let's go back 33 years to the company name I chose, very, you know, sort of weird company name in the US where nobody knew what it meant, how to pronounce it or how to spell it. But my indicator of my emotional intelligence today is, how am I cultivating and harvesting joy in my life? Not just for myself, but for others as well.
Hmm. How do you keep yourself in alignment?
Meditating helps. I meditate every morning. I try to do it, you know, I sometimes do it during the day as well. You know,
people always say that they meditate.
Well, I truly do. I have been doing it for a long time. It's the one thing there's a lot of things I don't do. All yoga is so hard for me.
Use an app or?
I don't. I actually do to sleep now. I do use Insight Timer as my go to sleep meditation app. That is relatively new phenomena the last 3 months. I really wanted to get myself off of, I was taking Advil PM, you know, not just two, but like four a night, because I was on a book tour and I was like all over with time zones and I didn't really want to do Ambien or anything that was really strong. But taking four Advil PM a night, not good. Not good for your liver. And so I really got to a place where I started to say, you know what? I need to really take the meditation that I do in the morning that actually really helps me to sort of center myself for the day and take it to the evening and take it to bedtime. And it's actually been great. It's usually if I have a lot of time, I'll do a 20 minute meditation that is, you know, that she takes me through, or he or she. But sometimes it'll only be 5 minutes. But my morning meditation is a TM meditation with a mantra for 20 minutes, 10 to 20.
TM?
TM. Yeah, I know. It's like
Transcendental meditation.
And funny enough, I've tried a lot of other meditations and I've loved it. And I've done silent Vipassana meditation retreats, you know, canoeing and for a week silent canoeing from island to island in the Loreto Bay and the Sea of Cortez in Baja. But at the end of the day, TM works for me.
So where can people like get involved with the stuff that you're doing in the world today? Does it come down to Baja?
Yeah, you can do whatever. Read my books. The way you can be introduced to it is go to chipconley.com, spelled C-O-N-L-E-Y in terms of the last name. You can go to my LinkedIn page, has a lot of articles I've written. So there's Facebook and mostly Facebook, different sites. But you could go to modernelderacademy.org. to learn more about that and the week-long programs we do down there. And it is actually a social enterprise, which means we offer over 60% of our people in our first year were on some form of scholarship that we gave them. So you shouldn't feel inhibited from coming and experiencing the academy just because of financial need of being a challenge.
So you said that you're spending a lot of time with elders now.
I am. Well, elders are all ages, yes.
Yeah. But do you find people talking about this period of their life? You called it the gooey, dark and gooey cocoon phase, and we do as well. But do you think it's something that everyone has gone through at that stage?
I don't know if everybody has gone through it, but I do know that people in their 40s are really struggling. I think there's an emotional equation to describe the 40s, which is disappointment equals expectations minus reality. And your 40s are the decade where you actually come face to face with your expectations and you start to realize some of the ways you thought your life was going to be may not end up the way it's going to be. And I think that, you know, one of the nice things about the 40s is realizing, okay, you can work harder to make reality better. The only way that that equation gets better is disappointment equals expectations minus reality. Either reality gets better or expectations go lower. And ultimately for most people, it's actually expectations go lower or they shift. And in that process of shifting and what Brené Brown calls the great midlife unraveling, you sort of unravel the way you've spun your life and you start to try to live it differently. And it's a painful period because it means in many ways you have to break out of the mask, break out of the identity, the mindset, the way people have seen you. And for some of us, that's really quite hard, but there's a liberation on the other side of it.
Chip Conley, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. It's been just a pleasure to be here.
Belly of the Beast Life Stories Season 1 In Our Belly is now complete. And in this moment, I wish to express my sincere gratitude to all 13 of our guests. It has been a distinct honor and a privilege to be fully present when they shared their most vulnerable story. And if you've been listening with us, you know exactly why I choose to sit and listen. These stories are healing, powerful, uplifting, relatable. And that's why I've created this show and will continue to do so, because I want to get these stories out to you. If you have been listening and you've been moved by a story or have feedback for one of our guests, please email me directly, david@inourbelly.com. I'll keep it personal. But there are so many more stories to tell. Life is full of seasons. I have started creating content for our next season, For Love of My Child. Season 2 will be particularly personal to me as my sister and very close friends share their story with us. Thank you for being part of our family at Belly of the Beast Life Stories. See you in a very short minute. Be well. What an extraordinary life story. If this story moved you, help enable our mission and keep this advertising-free podcast going by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. I'm responsible and accountable for this podcast, but I don't do it alone. Milos Brochetta is our sound engineer, Artie Wu is our advisor, and many others have helped along the way to bring the story to life. Thank you for listening. I'm David All, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. Thank you for rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts and sharing it with a friend or two. Stay tuned. I'm working on some stories that you need to hear.